16. For the Betterment of the Bureau. White and his men felt a growing sense of progress. A Justice Department prosecutor sent Hoover a note saying that in the few months since White had assumed command of the investigation, many new angles of these cases were successfully developed, and a new and enthusiastic spirit seemed to pervade the hearts of all of us. Still, White faced the same problem with the investigation of Molly Burkhart's murdered family that he did with his inquiry into Roan's death. There was no physical evidence or witnesses to prove that Hale had carried out or ordered any of the killings. And without an airtight case, White knew that he'd never be able to bring down this man who hid behind layers of respectability, who called himself the Reverend, and who used a network of patronage to influence the sheriff's office, prosecutors, judges, and some of the highest state officials. In a stark report, agents noted that Scott Mathis, the Big Hill Trading Company owner and a guardian of Anna Brown and Lizzie, was a crook and evidently in the power of Hale. That an associate of Mathis's served as a spy for Bill Hale and the Big Hill Trading Company and does all the framing for them and their crooked deals in skinning the Indians. That the chief of police in Ponca City had taken money from Bill Hale. That the chief of police in Fairfax will do nothing against Hale whatsoever. That a local banker and guardian will not talk against the Hale faction for the reason that Hale has too much on him. That the mayor of Fairfax, an arch crook, was Hale's close friend. That a longtime county prosecutor was part of Hale's political machine and was no good and crooked. And that even a federal official with the Office of Indian Affairs was in the power of Bill Hale and will do what Hale says. White realized that his struggle to obtain justice was just beginning. As a bureau report would put it, Hale dominated local politics and seemingly could not be punished. Hoover had earlier praised White, saying that because of his handling of the case, conditions have been peaceful and I have had no complaint or criticism whatsoever, and this has been a great relief to me. Yet Hoover, that slender bundle of high-charged electric wire, as one reporter described him, was growing increasingly impatient. Hoover wanted the new investigation to be a showcase for his bureau, which he had continued to restructure. To counter the sordid image created by Burns and the old school of venal detectives, Hoover adopted the approach of progressive thinkers who advocated for ruthlessly efficient systems of management. These systems were modeled on the theories of Frederick Winslow Taylor, an industrial engineer who argued that companies should be run scientifically, with each worker's task minutely analyzed and quantified. Applying these methods to government, progressives sought to end the tradition of crooked party bosses packing government agencies, including law enforcement, with patrons and hacks. Instead, a new class of technocratic civil servants would manage burgeoning bureaucracies in the manner of Herbert Hoover, the great engineer, who had become a hero for administering humanitarian relief efforts so expeditiously during World War I. As the historian Richard Gid Powers has noted, J. Edgar Hoover found in progressivism an approach that reflected his own obsession with organization and social control. What's more, here was a way for Hoover, a desk-bound functionary, to cast himself as a dashing figure, a crusader for the modern scientific age. The fact that he didn't fire a gun only burnished his image. Reporters noted that the days of old sleuth are over, and that Hoover had scrapped the old gumshoe, dark lantern, and false mustache traditions of the Bureau of Investigation and substituted business methods of procedure. One article said, "He plays golf. Whoever could picture old sleuth doing that?" Yet an ugliness often lurked beneath the reformist zeal of progressivism. Many progressives, who tended to be middle-class white Protestants, held deep prejudices against immigrants and blacks and were so convinced of their own virtuous authority that they disdained democratic procedures. This part of progressivism mirrored Hoover's darkest impulses. As Hoover radically streamlined the Bureau, eliminating overlapping divisions and centralizing authority, White, like other special agents in charge, was given greater command over his men in the field, but he also became more accountable to Hoover for anything the agents did, good or bad. White had to constantly fill out efficiency rating sheets, grading agents on a scale of 0 to 100 in such categories as knowledge, judgment, personal appearance, paperwork, and loyalty. The average score became an agent's overall grade. After White told Hoover that he had occasionally given an agent a 100 rating, Hoover responded sharply, writing, "I regret that I am unable to bring myself to believe that any agent in the jurisdiction of the Bureau is entitled to a perfect or 100% rating." Hoover, who believed that his men should conquer their deficiencies the way he had conquered his childhood stutter, purged anyone who failed to meet his exacting standards. "I have caused the removal from the service of a considerable number of employees," he informed White and other special agents. "Some have been lacking in educational ability and others have been lacking in moral stamina." Hoover often repeated the maxim, "You either improve or deteriorate." Though Hoover conceded that some might deem him a fanatic, he reacted with fury to any violations of the rules. In the spring of 1925, when White was still based in Houston, Hoover expressed outrage to him that several agents in the San Francisco field office were drinking liquor. He immediately fired these agents and ordered White, who, unlike his brother Doc and many of the other cowboys, wasn't much of a drinker, to inform all his personnel that they would meet a similar fate if caught using intoxicants. He told White, "I believe that when a man becomes a part of the forces of this bureau, he must so conduct himself as to remove the slightest possibility of causing criticism or attack upon the bureau." The new policies, which were collected into a thick manual, the Bible of Hoover's bureau, went beyond codes of conduct. They dictated how agents gathered and processed information. In the past, agents had filed reports by phone or telegram, or by briefing a superior in person. As a result, critical information, including entire case files, was often lost. Before joining the Justice Department, Hoover had been a clerk at the Library of Congress. "I'm sure he would be the chief librarian if he'd stayed with us," a co-worker said, and Hoover had mastered how to classify reams of data using its Dewey Decimal-like system. Hoover adopted a similar model, with its classifications and numbered subdivisions, to organize the Bureau's central files and general indices. Hoover's personal file, which included information that could be used to blackmail politicians, would be stored separately in his secretary's office. Agents were now expected to standardize the way they filed their case reports on single sheets of paper. This cut down not only on paperwork, another statistical measurement of efficiency, but also on the time it took for a prosecutor to assess whether a case should be pursued. White himself could be a demanding superior. An agent who worked under him in Oklahoma recalled that each of his men was supposed to know his job and do it. Another man who later worked under White said he could be honest till it hurt. Yet White was more forgiving of frailty than Hoover was, and he often tried to shield his men from the boss man's anger. When Hoover became inflamed after one of White's agents failed to use the one-page format in a report on the Osage murder cases, White told Hoover, "I feel that I, myself, am altogether to blame, for I looked over this report and gave it my approval." Under Hoover, agents were now seen as interchangeable cogs, like employees in a large corporation. This was a major departure from traditional policing, where lawmen were typically products of their own communities. The change helped insulate agents from local corruption and created a truly national force, yet it also ignored regional difference and had the dehumanizing effect of constantly uprooting employees. Speaking only with the betterment of the service in mind, White wrote to Hoover that he believed an agent who was familiar with the region and its people was more effective. He noted that one of his agents who had gone undercover as a Texas cattleman in the Osage case was ideally suited to working on the frontier. But put him in Chicago, New York, or Boston, and he is almost worthless. Hoover was unmoved. As one of his yes men wrote in a memo, "I do not agree with Mr. White at all on this matter. An agent who is only acquainted with the characteristics of inhabitants of one section of the country had better get into some other line of work." At a makeshift training school in New York, agents were indoctrinated in the new regulations and methods. Hoover later turned the program into a full-fledged academy at Quantico, Virginia. Agents were increasingly trained in what Hoover hailed as scientific policing, such as fingerprint and ballistics techniques, and they were taught formal rules of evidence gathering in order to avoid cases being dropped or stalled, as had happened with the first Osage investigation. Some agents, especially older ones, despised Hoover and his edicts. One veteran agent advised new recruits, "The first thing you gotta do is unlearn everything they taught you at the seat of government. The second is to get rid of those damn manuals." In 1929, an agent resigned with the complaint that Hoover's initiatives were directed against the personnel rather than against the criminal. White, too, sometimes chafed at Hoover's rules and whims. But he clearly relished being part of the Bureau, being swept up in events greater than himself. He tried to neatly type up his reports and touted the virtues of scientific policing. Later, he would replace his cowboy hat with a fedora and, like Hoover, take up golf, putting the ball across the immaculate greens where the new American men of money and power and leisure gathered. White would become almost indistinguishable from one of Hoover's college boys.